Hello everyone, I am Mirta Hurtado Rivas. No VIPs or rock stars, just simple people sharing their life stories to trigger discussions around important topics, or simply to inspire us to embrace challenges ourselves. Welcome to Leaderching. Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of Leaderching. My guest today is my good friend, Roy Meltzer. Roy manages the computing technologies department at Ehrlich Group, one of the leading patent firms in Israel. By doing that, he helps innovators from the high-tech industry in this beautiful country. So hello, Roy, how are you?
I'm great, how are you, Mirta?
I'm good, thanks for being my guest today. So let's dive directly into the couple of questions that I have prepared for you. First, I want to know, what is it that you wanted to become as a little boy?
The first time I remember I really set my mind on something was at the age of 15. I thought I would be a film director. I started to go to the, I had a subscription and I started to see movies like, classical movies between 2 and 4 times a week. And it was based on experience that I had with movies of Woody Allen. So I thought it might be a good model for me.
Yeah, great movies, for sure.
Yeah.
So let me know, was there anything in your environment, in your family, that drove you to this kind of discovery passion that you had at that age?
Nothing in the family. I think it was more exposure in school. It was a department, media department, and I elected it over others, and it was just it was interesting because you were involved in creation. It wasn't just learning. From being exposed, you could take part in creating things, and it was the first time I think I really took part in creating something, because before that I wasn't such a good I didn't have a good drawing skills or the patience for writing stories. So that's the first time that I really created something.
So when you look at your career or your studies, so after high school, did this passion for creativity or this kind of wanting to be involved in something creative stay with you? Or is it something that totally changed due to the other circumstances?
I think it's very, when I think about it now, after school, I went to the army for 3 years. I was in the Navy. And when I came out of the Navy, just going to be a film director in the economic arena of Israel seems like a weird, funny dream. It doesn't make any sense. And I probably didn't believe in myself enough that I will become something like Woody Allen from Israel. And so I went and studied law and computer science, and I was more attracted to computer science because you can code something, create something, and it was more interesting for me. And after a year, and I worked as a programmer, and it was really nice. And after that, when I went to a law internship, I noticed that I don't like the legal side so much. I don't like the fighting side so much. I don't like making money from other people's problems. But I found this weird thing that's called patent attorney, where you are once again involved in creation. And you are once again part of the new and the new things and the important things. So I really liked it, and this is how I find myself in today's profession.
Okay, so it sounds really like this involvement in kind of building up something together with other people is really something that you really like. Now, you very nonchalantly mentioned that you were 3 years in the Navy. This probably for Israelis is normal, but I know that you know that it's not very normal abroad. So how did you feel about this fact that you went to the to the army, to the navy in this particular case, and what did it do to you those 3 years?
Well, it's like a fast track for being an adult. When you think about it, it takes you from a place that you're not responsible for anything, because Israel, in the end, is a Western country. You don't have child labor or something like that. You don't just live your funny and great life, and you go to school and you hitchhike and you drink and you have fun and you meet friends and boys and girls and all the fun that you can have as a child and or someone is growing up. But then you go to the army and then you get this responsibility on weapon systems, on people. So you become in certain positions. And I became in a certain, after a few months or a year, you're becoming commander. You have people who are, you tell them what to drink, when to drink, what to eat, when to eat, what to sleep, when to sleep, what to wear, where to wear, what to learn, when to wear, if they can call, if they can stand, if they can sit, if they can. So you get all this responsibility of being in, you know, a teacher, an officer, a parent, all together, and you're only 19. So you get all this responsibility and it's in your hand. So it's very fast track to become an adult, to understand, to be responsible. So I guess it's really changed you. It's changed your dreams for some people. It's changed your tools, your abilities, how you believe in yourself. It's complicated.
I can imagine. So our audience obviously doesn't know, but you have children of your own. How do you look at, you know, the fact that they may need to go to the army as well at a certain age? And what do you think it's, you know, is it going to be different? Or do you believe it's something that would probably have a similar impact?
It's going to be different. The army is a little bit different. It's changes, it's becoming more modern. Situation is becoming a little bit more stable. Do I think about it every day? No.
That's good news.
Do I believe that it's going to happen? Yes. I don't think, you know, when I was young, we always say, by the time you will be 18, there will be peace and there will be no need in a mandatory army. But it's not happening so much. So when I went for 3 years, I will go for 2 years and 8 months, maybe two years and 6 months. So there is a reduction in the period, but it's still very long. In the end, when, you know, from my age today, 42, I don't think I wasted those years. It doesn't seem to me like a waste. But I really hope we can guide them into being in a position that they will gain something from this experience, because this experience can be very intense and has an effect on your life.
So maybe if we just start switching to the other topic, and I think probably what you just told us now is a nice kind of connection to it, because I assume you just said you take on a lot of responsibility for people at a very young age. And obviously this shapes your kind of, you know, view onto what responsibility means. And a part of responsibility also goes together with the topic that we pursue at Leader Change, that is leadership, right? So you probably came across, you know, across leaders when you were at the Navy, but also obviously in your professional career. Can you share a little bit what for you a good leader is?
A good leader. A good leader is someone that shows the target without, at least in the army, it's very strong. If you see a good leader, it shows you the target, but is not involved in every single action of you getting there. And he's getting it not by fear, not by his position, but by we in the army, we always said after me. So that someone that is showing you that he's doing the same effort and towards the same target, and he's asking people, he's not asking them, he's telling them after me, we're all going after me. So he's giving you an example. I think the Israeli leadership is very affected by the army. It's at a very hierarchical and sometimes maybe a very aggressive a little bit. It changes the nature. I think the model of a good commander for many people, I don't think many people in the army has a model which is not at the same gender as they are. There is in most places there are a separation between women and men. There are manly jobs and women jobs. So a woman usually has a woman commander. A man has a man commander. It also has an effect. You don't even see those different kind of commanders when you learn about what is a leader at a young age. So the first leaders that you meet are always almost from your gender.
Interesting. And is there a discussion about that in Israel? You know, is there a kind of a mindset that will challenge that, or that sees that as maybe being at some point not ideal if you're only surrounded by leaders or examples of your own gender?
I don't think it comes from this point. It's more coming from giving both genders equal opportunities. And when, so you see women who are pilots and you see women who are leading, operating complicated, complex weapon systems, but there are positions that you don't see them. You don't see them in the infantry, you don't see them in the Navy much. You wouldn't put two or three women in a submarine for a long period with the other 60 men. So it's like there are issues. It is a discussion, it's an active discussion. There is now a discussion about adding women more for the tank division. Where they have to carry a lot of weight. There is an argument that they can't carry a lot of weight. So there is the physical measures that sometimes set the discussion. It's really progressing. There are some combined and mixed units. Border control is usually mixed units. But it's an ongoing discussion. But I think that's really mold the thinking in the long run.
Okay. If you think about your professional career, so more in your role as a patent attorney since you started, do you think that the managers you had displayed any type of kind of, you know, leadership styles or elements that were different from what you just mentioned, or do you think it kind of overlaps?
Well, I think in my career, maybe as a software programmer, you had more examples of army leadership. But when I went to become patent attorney, it's completely changed. I don't think it was more in my the firm that I'm now. It's more Darwinistic management. It's trying to find the path to the place that you are the best or perform the best in, and the fittest survive, or the fittest prevail. Those who doesn't fit the job, they are just, you know, sometimes they just find themselves in a different job. They are not good in drafting, maybe they're good in prosecution. So there is something that you try to find a place that are realistic, the optimum for each one. And you're trying to give them an example. to the people you're working with. And I think it's coming from all management, on management layers. And when it comes to
Okay,
gender,
so if I hear you, it seems like you follow kind of the strengths finder, right? It's very common nowadays. You look at people's strengths and try to push the strengths of someone instead of looking at the weaknesses, because the belief is that if you build up strengths, actually that will make you optimize your capabilities in a specific area and can then excel there, right? Do you think that the trust element is also important? Because it sounds like when you say, like, you know, people are accordingly to their capabilities, they may be moved around until they find the ideal role. It seems like there also needs to be a relationship of trust between manager and employees so that that can happen, right?
Yes, I think that if the employee doesn't trust the employer that he's giving him the most suitable task, there is a problem, because he doesn't feel that he's optimizing his skills. So there must be a correlation. The good thing in my profession, I think that unlike in litigation, when you have long terms, you know, long rounds, you know, sometimes litigation that takes 4 years, 3 years. When it comes to a patent draft, you prepare it in less than 6 weeks. If you expedite the examination, you have it allowed, granted, or being rejected within less than a year. So you can really see the improvement, the change, the effectability, the effectiveness. You get very fast feedback from clients. So it's much easier to have those evolution rounds. You don't have to wait 4 years to see if this is a failure or a success. So you can see who's good in what very fast.
You just mentioned one of the words I like, actually, even though it's not such a nice word, but you mentioned failure. So how did you manage or handle failure throughout your professional career? And I would assume you also sometimes failed. So how did you manage that?
Probably not very successfully, but it's something that sometimes takes sleep from your night. It's something that you try to learn from and to avoid and try to document and analyze. You don't want to have it again happening. I always try and ask myself why, and try to map it and try to implement how to avoid it again. And this is something that changed, because I think when I was younger, I would probably tend to blame. I would tend to blame the other side, to blame the situation, to blame. So, for example, if I got in school, and this is something I got from my parents, you know, if I didn't succeed well, they blamed the teacher. So it wasn't your fault. It's the teacher, the other friend's fault, the school fault. And this is something that can be very, very strengthening sometimes. You know, you are a Superman, a superhero. You can do everything. But it leads you to a place that you have a very fragile ego. It's very easy to
burst the bubble.
It's a problematic. It's very easy to burst the bubble, because you can only blame to a certain level. And if you're realistic and do also a data analysis, so blaming doesn't help. So you have blame, you have to, and it's also a trick, because it's very important to build your self-esteem and your kids' self-esteem, but you don't want them to blame. You want them to understand, to learn. So that's a change. That's something that changed over time. Today, instead of blaming, I'm always blaming. Maybe I'm, it's like, you know, it's like a conundrum. It's like moving from one side to the other. So blaming others, blaming yourself, blaming others, blaming yourself. So I'm trying to blame myself, but this is also sometimes not so good. You have to judge as more objectively as much as you can. Blaming yourself also doesn't
Yeah,
improve the outcome
I
sometimes.
like the idea of, and you mentioned it, and probably it's also because of your background, right? You mentioned analysis, you mentioned looking at data, you mentioned like doing this introspection, right? It's like, and I think it's something that when we're younger, we miss because we're just moving ahead, want to move ahead fast, want to get things done. And we don't spend much time analyzing failure. We're just putting it aside and wanting to go next. Whereas what you are sharing with us now is kind of if you take the time to analyze where the failure came from and what it represents, why it happened, and doing kind of lessons learned to avoid it happening once again, it has this kind of, you know, talking to yourself, analyzing yourself, which I think is a big part of being self-aware, right? Knowing what is it that triggers you to do something in a way that may put you at risk to fail. So I think that's very interesting. And I think I like it. Seeing another guest on the podcast said one time, it's like when there is an issue, don't forget that you are part of the issue, right? And that you have to look into how you are playing into that issue. Sometimes it's an issue, sometimes it's a failure, but there is kind of a dynamic component to it. So it cannot be the others on their own.
I think that you cannot really, when in computer science, we have neural network. When you have a neural network, you put images inside, for just for example, data inside, and you tell, and the neural network is learning. It's learning from the data that is fed into it. There is a training set, a training of data. So you tell her, a cat, a dog, a cat, a dog, not a dog, not a cat, not a cat, and not a dog, a cat, a dog. So you have to train it. And it trained with data, and you have to show it good examples and bad examples. A good network cannot be trained without bad examples. You cannot train it without telling them, look, this is not a dog. Okay, if you only tell her what is good without saying, without showing her failures, she doesn't learn. And we have a one neural network, and it has to be trained with failures and success. So we have to feed it with failures and success. You have to learn from it. You cannot ignore it and put it aside. And this is, you have to give the right weight to your decision when you make them again. So it's an
I
important
like a lot the
process.
analogy, and I think it would speak to many, especially of the younger people, where this kind of, you know, where we learn about this machine learning and all this stuff to our days and becomes more and more normal to talk about it. I think it's an excellent way to explain that in order actually to kind of get a machine to recognize certain things, obviously, well, you have to feed it with thousands of images of the right thing, but at the same time, you have to feed it with thousands of images which are similar to the cat, right? And so in order to pick the cat and dismiss the dog, so to say. So I think it's, yeah, I like the analogy. It makes a lot of sense that we as well with our own system in the head need to be aware of what's the good stuff, but also what's the bad stuff in order to kind of distinguish it and then base on that our decisions. So we've talked a bit about leadership, mixed it up with some other stuff now. One of the topics that I am passionate about, and you've mentioned it already, and I think we've covered it to a certain extent, I just want to dig a little bit deeper into it, is gender equality. So you mentioned that actually there is a lot of thought about how to enable Israeli women to be able to fulfill a lot of the roles that were foreseen actually at the beginning more for men, and that there continues to be a discussions, for instance, in the army as to what women are able or not able to do due to their biologic force, for instance, or strength or not. How do you see this happening in just a general day-to-day society? Is there based because the army has such an important role in the society, is it a given that women are maybe more equal in Israel than elsewhere?
I don't think so. I think because the society is very, think it's a very aggressive society, relatively. So there is a lot of appreciation to power. And the women power is not always in being strongest or to be the ones that is being always heard or always funny or always saying something. It's not so sometimes it's a different wisdom. And I think that you get this appreciation and you see them more appreciated. And it's also because, for example, in the high-tech industry, when you judge more by the outcome, you have a lot of way of judging employees by their throughput. So you ask yourself a question, what is the return of the investment of the employee, and you try to evaluate it, and then it's a fair game. There's a job to be done, and there is a time to do it, and some people can and some people can't. It doesn't matter if it's a man or a woman. But there is, I think, and I think in Israel, most of the economy is based on the high-tech industry and R&Ds and development. I think there's also another factor we didn't talk about it is that the number of people, women who are going to study science degrees is lower than the number of men that want to study science degrees, math, computer science, electrical engineering. And I think this is the more important factor for equality in the Israeli economy market, job market. And we're not at a 50-50 percent yet. We don't see that in the management. We don't see it in the working. In our office, for example, it's not true because we have more women than men in profession. But I don't think this is the example. I have very little amount of women inventors. Not as much women inventors as there are men inventors. It's not Israel
Well,
related. It's a
I
worldwide
agree.
phenomenon. I think so, especially in computer science, electrical engineering, you see less women. In biology and chemistry, it's different, but I think, I'm not sure. But in my field, it's very easy to see
So you mentioned
the difference.
another keyword that I really think is extremely important when we talk about equality, and not only between women and men, but just in general, right? When we talk about diversity, and there might be all the different diversities that we can think of. I think education, right? Education seems to be, again and again, and not only, as you mentioned, the case of Israel, what you just mentioned with respect to scientific studies is well reflected in other countries as well. Whereas we are getting better in the biology, chemistry area. I see it within Novartis. We have more and more people, females, studying that and going through it. I still see that one of the trigger points is really when you choose what to study, right? And depending on what you choose what to study, now, for instance, in Israel, where the economy is strongly driven by high tech, so that obviously will have an influence. But also in other countries where it's not the case, we still see that there is a lot of jobs where that women don't pick, right? And I always wonder, right? Because we try to be kind of more open-minded with the new generation, right? So, for instance, with your children. But I'm not sure if we will. If we will reach our goal of getting already them, this generation, this upcoming generation, to actually truly be diverse and achieve equality. Any thoughts on that? Any thoughts as to on how are we doing with respect to the generation that is upcoming?
I think it's very society dependent. This is the problem with the the change that we have now in the world is that I think that you have the gaps are becoming wider between countries, between economies. And I think in some economies you will find more opportunity and more pressure for equality and more pressure for science education for women, for kids, for girls. And in some of it, you would not see it. And some parents, you know, in the end, you are bringing with you some kind of a model, and your model for parenthood is your parents, and they raised you. So it's very hard to raise your kids differently.
Yeah.
They raised you, and so there is a different. I'm not saying that it's easier to be a man than a woman, but there is a different pressure that is applied in different on different genders. And even with my daughter, I think, and my son, I have to work on myself to put the same requirements from both of them. Like,
yeah, sure. I think you just mentioned the fact, right? It's so, because it's ingrained in us, the way we were raised, and even though we are very well aware and we've read so many things and we are aware of the things that you shouldn't be doing, it's very tough to just constantly do it, because a lot of things we should just do by automatism, and also because we don't have our, you know, the next generation is not the scientific lab test or whatever, it's real life, right? So you have real life kicking in at the same time. So it's not as easy as we may think of. So this leads us to my last question. And actually, I would like to know if you could go back and speak to yourself in your 20s. What advice would you give Roy?
Take risks. Take risks. I don't know if I would listen to myself.
That's a good one.
but take risks. And don't take it to the heart so much. Not everything is worth your. You can learn from everything, but you don't have to be take it. I think one of the reasons that I said when I was younger, I cannot be a good litigator because I cannot take it objectively without being angry on the other side. On the lies, the small lies, on the small inaccuracies, manipulative behavior. And today I'm in a different place. Today I think I can manage it better, but I think it could help me if I could manage it better when I was younger. Maybe it's also part of taking risks, but you know, just ignore it. Don't be angry. Find to control your anger and take risks.
Well, thank you so much, Roy. I think taking risk is certainly something that I embrace as well. I think I was a kind of a little chicken when I grew up. I was scared of many, many things. And it's only once I started to embrace the fact that when things go wrong, it's not actually always that bad. That you can then just start again, try again, and look for something else. So I like it. So it's something that definitely, is appealing, brings a, you know, kind of makes sense to me. And I'm sure that our audience of today will appreciate everything you have shared with us. Thank you so much, Roy, for being my guest today once again.
My pleasure. It was a pleasure.
Bye.
I hope you liked this episode of LeaderChink in English. Don't forget to give us a thumbs up on your respective platform and subscribe to our podcast. See you soon!